welcome to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and Charlotte Metcalf, editor of the Oldie Supplements. And we're talking about the terrific new July issue of The Oldie. And I really like this article by the great Tony Adams, former captain of Arsenal in England. And as the World Cup opens, he remembers 30 years ago, the famous Euro 96 tournament, when England went out on penalties, inevitably, to Germany, inevitably, in the semi-finals, inevitably.
Oh dear, that's not good when we're in a match tonight, exactly. As we record this.
Exactly. What many people didn't know is that Tony Adams was going through his own crisis. In that year, 1996, his wife had left him, his children had been removed from him thanks to his dangerous, damaging drinking, and it was in that summer, 30 years ago, that he had his last ever drink, having gone on a 44-day bender. And the thing I loved about this article was Tony's extreme honesty. He describes going to a nightclub, Chaplin's in the West End, talking to a pair of twins, and one of them went home with him to the Holiday Inn in Kensington, and he describes the next morning surrounded by empty bottles from the minibar. And she said, hello, when he didn't answer a question. Where are you? Who are you? It was the way she said it, like I was really sick. Her worried eyes could see that I was desperate. No, make that destroyed. I asked her how much I owed her, but she wouldn't take payment. And it's, as I say, completely honest about the depths of despair.
No, it really is good. And there's a fantastic description of him waking up. He's been on a ghastly yet another bender, probably part of this 44 days. And then he says, on the Saturday morning, in a scene that was both comic and tragic, I woke up in a bed full of chips. I may have thought myself a cut above street drunks, but my home had become my park bench, which I think is just brilliant.
Brilliant line.
Yeah.
And he says a saying in AA that I hadn't heard of, but that if you can't remember your last drink, you haven't had it. And he can remember it crystal clear. He can go right back to that social club on his last day drinking with a Guinness and a brandy, sitting there crying, completely heartbreaking.
But the really interesting thing I thought about this was that so many people, you know, they might have had their last drink, but it's a very deliberate last drink. But in this case, it didn't seem to be. He just sort of suddenly didn't want another one because he'd had so many. And there's this brilliant line, which I find absolutely astonishing, because I've never met anybody who has given up alcohol in this miraculous way as he seemed to do, when he writes, "This sudden lack of desire for alcohol was monumental for a guy who had hammered it. It was a bonkers miracle. And there came a strange feeling that everything was going to be all right." I mean, that is highly unusual, I'd have thought.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Really, you and I both know lots of people who have successfully given up drink, but only after 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 tries. But it obviously, he had hit the literal rock bottom. And as he says in this brilliant article, it no longer, booze was no longer giving him any hit at all.
No, but anyway, talking of journeys, because he obviously went on his, as they talk about in AA, your journey to serenity and so on. Can we talk about your brilliant piece, Harry, about the Odyssey?
If you must.
No, yeah. I loved it because you followed in Odysseus's footsteps to see what might have been real and whether he actually existed and made this journey. And there was, what I was really struck by was, tell us about the boat that went down.
Yes, well, this is because I was writing about it because the new film of The Odyssey, Christopher Nolan's film, The Odyssey, with Matt Damon as Odysseus, is coming out on July the 17th.
Have you seen it yet, Harry, the film?
I haven't. I've seen some clips, and I can assure you, from what little I know, Odysseus did not have a Massachusetts accent like Matt Damon. But at the same time, I don't mind those so-called mistakes, and other pedants have got very cross that Matt Damon or Odysseus in the film wears a red-plumed Spartan helmet, which is out of date, far too modern for the Odyssey, which took place, if it did take place, in around 1200 BC. But I don't mind those mistakes, because I think both the Iliad and the Odyssey are so Protean, to use the pompous word from Proteus, the Greek sea god who can change shape. They're so adaptable, those great myths, that you can modernize them, you can make mistakes, and you still communicate this extraordinary story of the Iliad and the Odyssey.
But what I thought was really great about this piece was that what you were picking on were the real bits where you could actually see where it might have been real. And tell us the bit you found about the, you know, where you visited the bit of the coast off Sicily, I think, where the storm killed the billionaire Mike Lynch on that terrible boat accident.
That's right. So, yeah, 2 years ago, in August 2024, the billionaire Mike Lynch was on holiday with his family on his own huge yacht, the Bayesian, to celebrate being acquitted in American court. And in an absolutely terrible storm, it sunk his ship, killing him, his daughter, and five others. And by a terrible coincidence, it was only a few miles away from the spot which is said to be where Odysseus sailed between Scylla, the man-eating monster, and Charybdis, the deadly whirlpool. Really close to where poor Mike Lynch and his daughter and friends died. And that makes me think that in the Odyssey, of course, those monsters like Scylla didn't actually exist, but I do think quite a lot of those monsters, like Charybdis, are based on genuine weather conditions. And you well know, Fruity, as somebody goes to Greece a lot, that the Mediterranean, although people think of it as a mill pond, can be very, very dangerous. It gets the great Meltemi southern wind in August. I once went on a press trip to Mykonos, to a flash hotel, and I arrived there, and the lovely hotel manager said, "I hope everything's fine, the food all right, yeah, drink all right." He said, "I'm very sorry, sir. Ribice has been washed away by the Meltemi." And the night before, it had been completely washed away, and I spent the next morning, I think I was alone in the hotel, watching as a dredger sucked up some sand from out to sea and rebuilt the beach, and that was the Meltemi. But so that was the point of my book, was to go in the footsteps of Odysseus or his wake all around the Mediterranean.
But you also went to Ithaca, didn't you, and found the remains of his palace. It was lovely and beautiful.
To Ithaca, where I'm sure many listeners have been, but very few people have been to what I'm sure is Odysseus's palace, only discovered in 1994, only proved to be the right date in 2010, so all very recently. Gosh. But because the Greek government haven't got enough money to look after these places, there's no fence, so it's great. You just go there, walk around it. I've been there several times, completely empty. But everything fits the description in the Odyssey.
Beautiful, so the building, olive trees.
The beautiful olive trees, like the tree that built Penelope and Odysseus' bed. The palace is, just like in the Odyssey, is on two flat terraced rock beds connected by a stone staircase. There's a Mycenaean bath and graveyard, which is the right date, around about 1200 BC. And amazingly, they found the moulds of a metal workshop. And it doesn't take too much romantic imagination to imagine that this might be where the 12 axe heads were made that were lined up in pairs to form a super narrow passage along which Odysseus fired his bronze-tipped arrow to prove that he was superior to the famous suitors. And everywhere I went, everything fits. So Troy, which I'm convinced does exist, is on this site on the western coast of Turkey. And I'm pretty convinced there was a war between the Greeks and an eastern tribe in around about 1200 BC. There's a burnt layer of the 12 cities on top of each other at Troy of exactly the right date. And if you accept there was a war between the Greeks and an eastern tribe, the Greeks had to get back home again or make a return. The Greek for return is a nostos. That's why we get the word nostalgia, pain in going back. And actually, there are lots of other epics called nostoi or returns, Greek epics, which only little fragments survive. Obviously, the most popular one was the Odyssey, because that was the one that survived in quite a lot of copies. And so I'm sure there were Greeks coming back, and they were going home. And so there's lots of embroidery on top of the truth. But I'm sure at the heart of it, there was a real story behind the Odyssey. Somebody said the Iliad and the Odyssey, although they're poems, are basically the first two novels. It's impossible to know whether we love those stories because they're the earliest surviving Western European stories, so they're imprinted into our mind, or because they are such perfect stories. You know, what could be more exciting than the world's strongest man, Heracles, or... They were very, very open about that fairly interesting subject, sex. That actually Odysseus, of the 10 years he spent going back from Troy to Ithaca, we think of him fighting all these monsters and whirlpools, but actually 7 years were spent with extremely attractive nymphs and goddesses. So he took his time getting back to his lovely wife. Which is a good link to two very good pieces, which I think you liked... In the current issue?
Yes, I did. I was really interested to read Liz Hodgkinson talking about a book she wrote 40 years ago about celibacy, because she
called Sex Is Not Compulsory.
Yes, with her husband. So she wrote very openly about a sexless... Her marriage had been sexless for about 6 years at that point, and it caused an absolute furore at the time. But, of course, nowadays, it's really interesting because there is a lot of celibacy around with the new generation.
She brings up the fascinating group, the hikikomori, the Japanese loners who barricade themselves in their flats and live like hermits while remaining virgins, and also, more scarily, the incels, yes, the involuntarily celibate young men who often in America end up killing people out of frustration. Absolutely terrifying. But it's a very, very interesting subject.
It is, and I thought what was... So it then sent me to Miriam Stoppard, who is absolutely wonderful. We have her writing for us because she's... I think she's an extraordinary person. And she is very keen on sex, having interviewed her on Radio Oldie. She thinks we should all be having... You know, women should be having loads of sex because our orgasms get better and better.
And it's also good for your health?
Very good for your health, yes. And actually, Kathy Lett says the same thing in a very different way. But anyway, Miriam has written, sadly, not a wonderful, joyous article about the joys of sex, but an absolutely harrowing article about being a young doctor. And when she was observing and learning the ropes, she saw a lot of breast cancer operations to remove the breast. And
in the early 60s, she qualified in 1961.
Yeah, and here's just a little taste of this article about the misogyny around at that time. What I saw again and again appalled me. You wouldn't do this to a dog. I'd seen heartlessness before when a surgeon spoke to a weeping woman who was waiting for breast cancer surgery. I know, he said, you're worried about your husband, that he'll only have one breast. I couldn't believe my ears. The crass misogyny floored me.
No, it's a brilliant article, and it's also very, very brutal. Yes. As a doctor, she's very, very good at describing the terrifying clinical details. So she saw this radical mastectomy, which is held up as the gold standard for breast cancer treatment at the time, but she describes that not just the lump, smallish lump, was removed, not just a segment of the breast, but the whole breast, plus the underlying chest muscles, the pectorals, plus the glands in the armpit, the axilla, to assess cancer spread. It's absolutely terrifying and brutal. And so, although the NHS is not in a great state today, that doesn't go on. Well, I think you say there still is a good deal of misogyny.
Well, I've come across it, and there's a very good bit as well, not just about the breast operations, but also quite operations which should be very routine for women, for fibroids, which are benign muscle tumours in the womb. And I'd had them. And she's writing here about how so many women went in to have them removed. And then she writes, would wake up to find not only had her womb been removed, but also, without consent, her pelvis had been summarily stripped of her ovaries and fallopian tubes. The reason commonly given by gynaecological surgeons was couched in terms such as, I just tidied everything up while I was in there and took everything away. Now, something similar did happen to me, which was very...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was very...
Without asking your permission.
No, they did, but they did not in any way warn me of how horrific it, the whole thing was going to be. And it really affected me very badly for a very long time. And it was just that it wasn't so much that they didn't warn me, it was just the unbelievably lackadaisical attitude to it. So anyway, I think she's... it's wonderful she's writing for us now. And as you said, on an optimistic note, thank God things have got quite a lot better.
Yeah. And there are, as well as these sort of very, very stirring, moving articles, Liz Hodgkins is actually also very funny about celibacy. So she wrote this book, as I say, 40 years ago, Sex is Not Compulsory, in 1986, which is an unfortunate time for her two sons, Tom Hodgkinson, editor of The Idler, who is our Town Mouse columnist, and her other son, Will Hodgkinson, rock and pop critic for The Times. And Will wrote a very good book called The House is Full of Yogis about his father joining a cult. But he talks about this celibacy book coming out in 1986, and he says, "It was a complete nightmare. I was 16 watching TV with friends at my co-ed boarding school when my parents appeared on a chat show. The sheer mortification of the school seeing my parents talk about sex on TV stayed with me for years." And you can imagine it's a difficult subject in the first place, difficult in relation to your parents, even more difficult to watch it on telly with your friends.
Well, I mean, we all know the horror. I mean, I didn't even want my parents to be seen by anybody. My parents were wonderful, but it was just that thing. And actually, it's quite cheering to know that that hasn't changed. It is one of those enduring, generationless things.
There's a very good Seinfeld episode where Jerry Seinfeld does the stand-up at the beginning of the show, as he always does, and he says he's longing to find out that he's adopted, because then his parents, who he loves, but he can't bear the idea of them having sex, but he knows they must have at least once to produce him. Wonderful to know he's adopted, because then they might never have had sex.
That's so funny. What a note to end on.
Thanks so much to Charlotte Metcalf for appearing on Radio Oldie, talking about the July issue of The Oldie.
And we're going to be talking about books next, aren't we? Yes.
And also, yes, in this issue, there is the Oldie Review of Books, which we'll be talking about next time. Thanks so much. This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.